Yeah, my name is Riyaz, and I have the former director of operations at the World Bank. First of all, what's your discourses? You have to be clear. But I have a very fundamental question, and allow me your reaction by agreeing with you, to what you said. As you mentioned, similarity in metaphysics, cosmology, and ethics. To what extent do these similarities between the two thoughts go beyond what is common human aspiration? My agnostic nature within me tells me it is a lot more, but I don't understand. It is a very fundamental question. What is unique about these similarities, which is more than we can have? What can happen in other people?
I do not believe that the idea that similarities are simply based on the similarity of human nature suffices. Human nature is too fluid to be permanent. It needs something else. And any kind of humanism which does not look upon the spiritual element within the human being is bound not to succeed. Now, these similarities which you just mentioned, and I mentioned in my small talk, are not only based on similarities of human nature, they're based on something more profound. It is true that there are also other very profound similarities with other traditions. For example, between India and the Islamic world. I've given over 10 lectures in India over decades on this very, very question, and there are also very profound similarities there. And this brings us to the profound question of similarity between the heavenly messages which have molded human souls in different societies. There was a question of similarity, structural and also metaphysical similarity between various religions of the world, which in fact have made it possible for the followers to display these similarities. Now that's, of course, a very important central story, but certainly a story for another day. But I believe the key similarity is not only between Islam and Confucianism, but between Islam and other great religions of the world, or Confucian and other great religions of the world, is not the commonality of human nature, it is the divine imprint upon human nature. And similarity in different imprints, which throughout history, various human collectivities and within various civilizations have received.
My answer would be relatively brief. What actually happened now is something that actually occurred just quite some time ago. In the early part of the Enlightenment, I said Confucian contribution was significant. Recently, a book by Nathan Israel is called Enlightenment Contested. In that book, he talked about the emergence of the Enlightenment immediately recognized by these great Western minds of two conditions, Islam and Confucianism, as the other. So when these traditions were perceived as the other, and the possibility of a profound reflections on the West became more powerful than, say, Hinduism and many other traditions. And it is in this sense, when you become relegated to the background, on the surface, as otherness. But this is only part of the story. A much more important story is Dr. Nasser's idea. In my study of Liu Zi, the question almost is like that. Liu Zi followed what a Confucian considered a major project of human flourishing, starting from even a person in fetus, or even started with the animal world or the plants and so forth. It's a gradual process. And you can see all kinds of points of convergence through this kind of narrative. But then the question about beyond. In other words, the real dialogue, which may turn out to be the most challenging, and of course all kinds of wrong conceptions may emerge. That is at the cosmological and metaphysical level, and how the Confucian world will be able to appreciate heaven not simply as some reality out there, but as an integral part of our experience, but continuous source of inspiration. And therefore, you can even say creativity in itself. Now that aspect, which is taken for granted in the Islamic world, is something still quite new, not alien, quite new. So this learning is extremely important. On the other hand, the question of practicality, how you do your major work in the ordinary existence of the daily life, it's something that the Confucian tradition continued over a very long period of time. That's one of the reasons why many people just assume that the tradition is secular and the tradition is not a spiritual humanism. And so there's a great deal of mutual interaction. But the last point I want to simply know is that all spiritual traditions confronted with the emergence of what we can call the sacredness of the earth will have to transform themselves. And in the, let's use two examples, the Christian and the Buddhist. The Christian tradition can no longer assert waiting for the kingdom of God yet to come. Let's pollute this place, because after all, it's the world of Caesar. And the Buddhists would not be able to say, let's wait for the Pure Land for the other shore. This is red dust. So all the traditions will have to develop two languages, a language specific to your religious tradition, but also the language of global citizenship. In facing, especially if Earth emerged, especially in our generation, we can see it holistically, from the mineral, soil, water, right now air. And we, as humans, now we have to recognize, turn out to be not only, not just co-creators in a positive sense, but the most powerful destructive force, not only for ourselves, but also for the cosmos as a whole. It's an old Confucian statement that in their disasters, human beings would survive, especially disasters from nature, because there's loving care, basically pervasive in the nature, in the natural process. But if the disaster is man-made, we will not be able to survive.
My question is about hydrogen or sustainability. We spend more time in East Asia, China, India, and Japan. Why? How the program progress for the data. And I wonder what makes greater this Asia more carbon and general for the second, I wonder whether Confucian patterns one of the reasons why East Asia is a different kind of scientism or social media. It's not related like the real observer, social media or communism. The intelligence we see in East Asia is a little bit different from there. I was wondering what your comment and your opinion about their Confucian popularism or sort of mediated from.
All right, it's a challenging question. I'll repeat the question briefly. The question is, what's the reason, historical or structural, why scientism continues so powerful in East Asia? A part of it is connected with Confucian paternalism. That's probably anti-democratic or soft or hard authoritarianism. And the first response is somewhat related to my earlier narrative about the emergence of enlightenment mentality. And enlightenment mentality, some of the other values were relegated to the background, such as liberty and human rights. But science became a very powerful symbol for saving the nation. It's a patriotic, it's a nationalistic. But science, instead of understood as a kind of scientific spirit, as you know, Dr. Nasser was trained as a scientist, studied at MIT. Now, the scientific spirit is a human spirit. But scientism is an ideology, the belief that you can use technology. You know, technology becomes deified. You believe you can use the secular world and totally politicize scientific ideology to change everything. That won't work. Now, you look at the Confucian tradition has undergone four generations of transformation from the period of Kang Youwei Wei Liang Qichao to Xiong Shi Li Mo Zongsan, and of course to the new generation, we say at least four generations. So there's a continuous critique of the outmoded paternalism. So Confucianism was criticized as male-oriented, as authoritarian, as hierarchical. But some of these brilliant Confucians were very powerful in terms of their self-reflexivity. So the new identity is both open, pluralistic, and self-reflexive. So in this sense, Confucian spiritual humanism may turn out to be a very powerful source for critiquing this totally deified scientific technology. Of course, it's a hopeful sign. And you can see the emergence of Confucian humanism all over China, including what we call the recitation of texts by young children from 8 to 13. They recite these texts. And when it started in Taiwan, now about 1 million in Taiwan, but for the last 10 years, according to one account, approaching 10 million Chinese children now can recite these texts. And of course, in these texts, it's human flourishing in the most comprehensive, you can say, anthropocosmic way, and which is diametrically opposed to scientism narrowly defined.
My name is Ahmed. I'm a professor of Quran. The Quran clearly explains why he sent the new revelations, the wahi or books. And his explanation is that the old revelations were changed and even corrupted by the human beings. That's why he sent a new one. And also Allah forbid us in discussing from about himself without receiving a direct information from himself. What you bring and carry into Islam and description and other beliefs and from the Greek and Hindu or Buddhist theology. So don't you find the Quran is enough for describing Allah himself? Number one, and then number two is the...
Can we have just one question?
Okay,
I just have one question, but I need to also check with Dr. Nasser here. Can I just ask it? Question, if anyone is building out of the wall here somewhere, I can't hear a thing. I say that according to the Quran, we interpret God sent revelation to humanity. Would it have been enough to say that there are other religious traditions that have revelations for
I'm very surprised at this question because the Quran insists that God did not send one revelation but many revelations. It's always in the plural. And you just asked the question, why are you raising your hand again?
But Allah
said
that the other revelations is changed so that He sent a new one.
That was the question,
though. I think you didn't understand the question.
He says
that according to
Quran,
That's not true. That's not true. There are certain verses of the Quran which reveal that some of the Jews and Christians who were born in Islamic content had carried that tahrif, what in Arabic is called tahrif, that is changing or deviating from the actual text that was revealed to them. Other verses of the Quran refer to anyone who has faith being saved. The issue you bring up has really nothing to do with this dialogue, but it's asking the question whether there's a multiple separate religion and so forth and so on. Anyone who participates in religious dialogue believes that such a thing is possible. And if he is among Muslims who believes that it's not possible, then he should not carry out the dialogue. But of all the scriptures of the world, there is none that is as universalist as the Quran. And also the definition of faith is for Muslim is to have an iman in God, beloved, and his books, kutub, not kitab, and his messengers, not rasul, but rusul. It's in the plural. And the idea that there were other revelations and that God has spoken to other people is shown throughout the verse of the Quran, where they call the ummat and rasul, and to every people that send a messenger, the Quran says. And in chapter 5, the famous verse that's quoted over and over again about having determine the Sha'a, the path, and Minhaj, also way for different peoples, and if God had wanted to create only one religion. This issue of trying to deal with the question of multiplicity of religions, or lack thereof, or religious pluralism, is a very vast and important issue. And it's, of course, it has an impact upon the Islamic Confucian dialogue, or Confucian, Hindu dialogue, or Islamic Buddhist dialogue, or any kind of dialogue, but if you do not accept the other side as having anything that's clearly the truth in their view, then it's just totally wrong. That's not a dialogue. The dialogue means accepting the other side as being valuable and a truthful member of the discourse. But so I don't think we should get into that issue now. And I have written so much on this issue, I just refer you to some of my writings where almost all of these questions that you pose are answered. The very first chapter of a book I wrote a few years ago after the September 11th tragedy called The Heart of Islam is called One God, Many Prophets. And it's all the verses of the Quran which pertain to that. You can refer to that. But I think
I'm not qualified to say anything, but I'm going to make one suggestion, because recently I've been very deeply involved in this problem. For a while, there's the assumption that modernization from westernization was a spatial term, to modernization a temporal term, to globalization is a unilateral progression. If you look at unilinear progression, then human destiny is defined in terms of economics and politics. This is wealth and power. But we know that economic globalization is a homogenizing process. Trade, finance, even drug, terrorism. But cultural globalization is more complex. And in the cultural globalization, many different spiritual traditions are either inspired or provoked to respond to this phenomenon. So my argument is that, of course, this one very important process of modernization as embodied in Western European country and more recently in North America. But we know East Asian societies also became modern, like Japan, or for Forbidden Dragons. You just cannot say that any of these societies are not modern, even by strict Western standards. Then you have to imagine the following possibility. If unilateral progression is falsified, which opens up to other possibilities, there will be a possibility of the Southeast Asian modernizing process. And that process will evoke some of the great values from Buddhism. there will be the Latin American, Russia, Islamic world, and in the long run, I think Africa as well. So many different kind of resources will be mobilized. So we need desperately a dialogue among civilizations. One thing that in America that we all suffer from, and of course the whole world suffer from, is this unilateralism. This belief that we have got it. So we could impose it on Iraq, we can impose it on Iran, all these other places. I think that notion, which I think is kind of an unholy alliance between the Christian right and market fundamentalists. And that unholy alliance now is being seriously critiqued. So in this sense, we enter into biological civilization.
My question was already more or less answered by Professor Nasser's last comment that there's one God, but many problems, many different ways. I mean, spiritual studies and cultural studies of religion, my question is, would there be a convergence, a real convergence of similarity among all religions? Given the fact that each religion is unique in its own way, in terms of its teaching, spiritual practice, and there are, of course, concrete differences between Islam and Christianity. Islamic tradition of emphasizing God, one God, salvation, divine revelation, divine wisdom, and so on. Whereas Confucian tradition of discussing the Tao, heaven, self-cultivation, learning, and so on. So, despite our often quest for searching for the convergence among all religions, there are concrete differences in terms of language, philosophy, so on. So how is it possible to develop a global language, one that would unify the differences among all religions?
There's a difference between convergence and dissolution of different components in a single reality. Many people think that the problems of the world can be solved by having a kind of global religion or world religion, and that all of the religions could converge to make one single world religion with putting their common values together. I stand completely against this. I believe that all of Hindu religion comes from the divine, and this would be purely human invention, and all the attempts since the 19th century by a number of religious movements, even within the Islamic world, such as Baha'ism, and within the Christian world, within the Buddhist world, Soka Gakkai, and many, many different worlds, have ended up in nothing. That's very different from the religions being able to point to their common values in order to face a world in which every single one of them is threatened. I think that is bound to happen more and more. But we are having a lot of ups and downs. Let me give you a concrete example. In China, that's not the case, but between Islam and the West, after 1,000 years in which the Prophet of Islam was vilified by Latin texts going back to the 11th century all the way down to the 19th century, whether you were the Bishop of Paris or Orientalist in German University, you were more or less right, whether the Orthodox Muslims spoke of nonsense about the Prophet of Islam. Things gradually began to improve. And a number of especially British scholars in the early 20th century, like Mongolia, Sir Hamilton Gibb, in France, Louis Massignon, Louis Gablet, Bertrand Bobin, people like that, Jeremy Rindes, but also some German scholars, especially later on, Anna Maria Schimmel, who wrote the remarkable book on the Prophet of Islam, they began to try to remove some of these old historical prejudices so there could be a meeting between the religions. And suddenly, after 9/11, much of this was undone, not all of it, much of it was undone. And the Christian right, in cohorts with the four extreme forms, Zionism and other elements, came together, and the vilification of the Prophet of Islam became central to the scene. In the United States, to be politically correct, you cannot criticize anybody. You cannot even criticize Geronimo. Some American Indian would protest on. You get not the blacks, not the Jews, not the Orthodox, not the Catholics, usually the 19th century. The only thing that's free game is Islam. You can make movies, you can have Pat Robertson go on the television every night and curse Islam. And this is not a laughing matter. It shows that this process of convergence doesn't smoothly flow historically. There are a lot of confrontations, conflicts, events that can turn it about. And you see another sign in a very different world with the rise of Hindu nationalism and the BJP and a kind of fascistic interpretation of Hinduism. You see what is happening in Gujarat, and of course on the other side of the Muslim Muslim that's come from Kashmir and other places, the Kashmir problem is such a sore in the eyes of everybody, both Muslims and Hindus. But the relation between Hindus and Muslims today is in many ways much worse than it was decades ago. Certainly during time Mahatma Gandhi and for the centuries when they used to live together and all these common theologies, translation of sacred texts, much more than Chinese, they translated the Upanishads into Persian and the Bhakti movement being led to Sufism. All of this has now been to some extent eclipsed by current events. So I feel there is a general flow towards greater accord between religions. But there are also many, many obstacles, to be overcome. But that must not be confused with the attempt to create a kind of United Nations religion, which many people have tried to do. And I've been approached during the last 50 years by many organizations to participate in this kind of thing, which I refuse to do. Because I believe that the authenticity of religion is like the authenticity of a high cultural work. If a Sung painting and Rubens were combined and make one single style of painting, the world would suffer. And the beauty of each religion, its spirituality, its sacred forms, its art, its metaphysics, that is something very, very precious as that Sung painting, even more so. And so I have always stood against the confusing between religions and the dilution of religions into a kind of least common denominator world movement of some kind, which will never move the souls of men and women anyway.
Yeah, that I totally agree. And we try to avoid kind of abstract universalism, this kind of ecumenical, seemingly ecumenical way, is like Esperanto. You know, Esperanto cannot become any kind of literature. The person who advocated Bernard Shaw, of course, noted for his English expression. Now, this attempt now to believe that, say, 50 years from now, there's only one language that matters. And Richard Rorty, who's a very famous American philosopher, once made the remark, after visit China, he said, maybe two. But in any way, the diversity of language probably persists. You know the worry, the serious worry of French intellectuals. On the other hand, it is very important to avoid close particularism, especially the close particularism that becomes aggressive, becomes not only aggressive, but at the same time, to believe that truth is only manifested in a very small group of followers. So we need to avoid the two. But at the same time, the importance of the dialogue among civilizations is not to find the lowest common denominator. It's to engage in a very thick self-reflection. And we want to involve in a dialogue between the Confucian, who is deeply involved in the Confucian culture, in Confucian philosophy, in Confucian history. And that's true. I would like to engage in a dialogue with Dr. Nasa because his deep involvement in the tradition, in understanding it, and yet that's open. You know, the image that I have is like digging a well. The deeper you dig into the well, the closer you come to the common spring of communication. So if you allow yourself to be totally abstracted from your roots, from your own traditions, you may be very ecumenical, may be very free, but inevitably it will be very superficial. And what we want to do now is not the global village in a very superficial sense. You know, the global village is now noted for difference, conflict, contradiction, and even outright discrimination. What we need is dialogue begins with tolerance, but it's not enough. It has to be involved in recognition. Recognition, the irreducibility of the dialogical partner. Then you have respect. With respect, there's possibility of mutual reference, mutual learning, and even to celebrate difference. And I like Clifford Geertz, even though I don't like his relativism, Clifford Geertz's notion that you can, if you confront radical otherness, it may turn out to be a liberating experience. Instead of imposing your narrow-minded rationality on something, if you don't understand, you try to appreciate. You try to extend your own horizon. Deep listening is important. Now I think we've lost it. And in the interreligious dialogue, not only we have to learn to listen, but also try to extend our horizon and to deepen our self-reflexivity. It is not an occasion for conversion, not an occasion for making statements imposed upon the other, not even an occasion for trying to correct perceived misunderstanding. It is really a genuine communication for mutual reference. So both are beneficiaries, and your own sense of your own tradition becomes deeper because this kind of interchange.
Our last question.
I am from China. My name is Yijewa. I am a visiting scholar of Georgetown University. Actually, in China, I work for the Institute of World Religion, the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. I met Professor Du Weiming in the second dialogue conference in Utah. So I'm very happy to meet you here. I have a very short question. I want to ask, is this kind of dialogue or interaction between these two great traditions sustainable or possible in current China? For me, in my appearance, I think the Chinese Muslims are experiencing a rigid Islamization nowadays. That means, in certain degrees that we see, they are trying to get rid of the Confucian, the other elements, such as the Confucianism elements from the Chinese itself. I want to know your opinion about that. Thank you.
So this is my question. But since you work in the world, Institute of World Religions, I'm sure you have some really informed answers. If you look at China, maybe 96 to 97% Chinese are Han Chinese. So that's huge. But even with that 8% or 7% so-called nationalities, we're still talking about millions, 80 million or more. Now, the question you talk about, Islamization of the Muslim community and become somewhat close to other religious traditions. And this is not my experience. And I was involved in these dialogues. I think the Han Chinese will become more reflexive. And I think one problem, you know, I said it in China, so I could repeat it here as well, the leadership in the 21st century, no matter what kind of leadership, whether it's in government, in business, or in economic community, ought to be musical to religious matters, or sensitive to religious matters, ought to be sensitive to questions of identity. the Chinese leadership, generally speaking, maybe the term is a little bit too strong, they are autistic to religion on one hand and that identity on the other. They want all these nationalities to become, quote, citizens for the wrong reason. And that is related to this glorification of science and technology. We give you all kinds of public facilities. We give you money. We raise your standards of living. We try to give you something that is well, that make you more powerful and make you wealthier. But I don't respect what you have. I don't have any interest in your religion, in something deeply move you. That's the problem with Tibet. That's the problem with the non-Chinese speaking Muslims. What the leadership ought to do now is to say, well, if they feel this so strongly, there must be some reason. You know, let's take an example, maybe neutral in this conversation, a Christian. If you try to provide all kinds of external values, such as money and power and so forth, if the person is a genuine Christian, if you say the only thing you should give up is your faith, you don't be a Christian, you be a Confucian, right? You be a communist, that will give you all these things. You're not going to seduce an authentic Christian to become that. So you need to have that sensitivity. So one thing we need to do if we perceive, I think we can perceive examples, you know, the case of Zhang Zhisheng, I think you may have in mind, this very radical, young Muslim writers and thinkers, they are very, very hostile to the larger environment. But that hostility has to be understood as being perceived by them, being humiliated, being undermined, being relegated to the background. So I think some kind of two-way traffic will have to be developed. And also I'm aware of the fact that the government is very much worried about certain kind of alliance between the non-Chinese speaking Muslims and of course Central Asian Muslim powers, therefore the United Front, that would threaten to China's not just integrity in terms of sovereignty, but stability. But I think even if you have that sense of worry, still to understand the nationalities, you know the famous anthropologist, Tian Xiaotong, China is 多元一体. It's one nation, but with many, many different manifestations. And now we put too much emphasis on oneness without any appreciation of multiplicity of cultural expressions.
We last covered were in Beijing. We were in Beijing. We were taken by our host, Dr. Wu Bingbing, who is a professor at the University of Beijing and also in an Arab business with some years in Syria and very far man. He said, we have a lot of Islamic restaurants. I want to take you there. So every Islamic restaurant that would take us to very good food, they would play music and they had dancing girls. And I was very surprised that they were not no Chinese. I said to him, "What? This is in the middle of China. First of all, what is this phenomenon?" So all did not know the Chinese. We love dancing girls, but the Chinese women don't know how to dance. They're all Uyghur. So I guess the minorities play some role. But joking aside, I could not agree more with. Tuiming and all the comments you made, I'm not in a position to make any comments about China, but the fact that Xinjiang, which was called Turkestan, Shah Eastern Turkestan in Islamic geography, and until 1860, in fairly recent times, was called Eastern Turkestan, Turkestan, Shah, has certain proclivities and attractions toward Central Asia with the demise of communism and the rise of the local cultures of Central Asia, which are of course Islamic. That attraction is going to increase, there's no doubt about that at all. And it's going to cause a geopolitical problem for China, not less important than Tibet, perhaps even more difficult to manage in the future. There's no doubt about that. But as within that context, nevertheless, the harmonious way for Muslims within China to live with the majority Han population, I think, is extremely important. And I felt that, putting the Xinjiang problem aside, I spoke with many, many Muslim leaders who came to see me from different places, that it's not going badly. It's not going badly at all. And that perhaps just due to mutual interests that China had with such countries as Pakistan and Iran and the role in Central Asia and the future of oil in Central Asia and the role that Iran can play to prevent American hands from reaching Central Asian oil and all kind of practical things that are going on, that these may be elements which will help the Islamic population within China itself to play a more important role intellectually also as a bridge between China and the Islamic world. And also bring China closer to the Islamic world intellectually and not only economically, as to some extent politically, as seems to be the case. But I think the concern of myself and Dr. Tuiming is way beyond these contingent matters. We're thinking of really the future of the human state in this world and the importance of the understanding without which human life cannot continue. Both on the level of understanding the other religiously and not vilifying the other, who are the other, and also accepting the other, which is nature, the world of nature, that is something that should need to be dominated and destroyed, but something to be cared for and nourished, without which we will not survive. And the battle that is at hand, both within China and within the Islamic world, vis-a-vis the impact of the West, not only for the Enlightenment, but of course all kinds of tremendous political and economic pressure that exists, are also to a large extent mutual, and I think the interaction between the two civilizations is bound to grow by leaps and bounds in the future. And at the heart of that lies the need for this understanding between Confucianism and Islam. I know that the Annals of Confucius were translated into Persian many, many years ago. They retranslated many times. The Tao Te Ching has been translated into Persian at least 10 times, not that much in Arabic, but in Turkish also. And one hopes that this is the beginning of a long process of mutual recognition, so that every Persian child who knows the name of Leo Tolstoy or Victor Hugo will also know the name of the Chinese writer, and vice versa. Vice versa, every Chinaman knows Kant and Hegel, but also know the Islamic thinkers who were living next door to them for such a long time. Thank you.